From WLVR Bethlehem and Lehigh University, this is the show that gets you behind the real lives of Lehigh faculty. This is Prof Talk.
Welcome to Prof Talk. This is Michael Persita. I'm here with author John Grogan, who has written Marley and Me and The Longest Trip Home. Marley and Me has recently become a motion picture. And the books Marley and Me and The Longest Trip Home were published in 05 and 08, respectively. Welcome to the show, Professor Grogan.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
So I was just wondering, your books were, as I said before, your books were published in 05 and 08, respectively. And the movie for Marley and Me came out in 05. Are you working on any novels as of now?
Actually, the movie came out in 2008, the same year the second book came out, which is...
I was getting confused.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
sorry.
That's fine. And I have done, since those books came out, I've done a whole series of children's books. And it was kind of an accidental thing. I would go to my readings for my adult books, and I'd see a lot of kids at them, especially for Marley and Me. And, you know, clearly my book was written for adults, and they're not appropriate for little kids to read. So I decided to write one children's version of the book. And it took off, and it was very popular in grade schools and elementary schools. And so I did another, and now there's like a whole series of those out. So they've been among my writing projects that have taken me up to the present.
All right. And would you like to see a movie adaptation of The Longest Trip Home?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that. It's a really personal story about my life, and I'm growing up in this Irish Catholic family in the Detroit area, and it's a pretty honest portrayal of what it's like to be in a family, you know, the goods, the bads, and everything like that. I think it would be a difficult movie to make because it takes place over 40 years. It starts with me as a six-year-old boy, and it ends with me as like a middle-aged man saying goodbye to my dying father. So it'd be a lot to pack into a movie. And in fact, you know, since I already had a movie made of my first book, it circulated in Hollywood, and different film studios took a look at it, and I think they agreed that it wasn't quite the kind of book that would go for a movie.
Speaking of the movie adaptation of Marley and Me, were you happy with the film adaptation of your work?
I was. You know, like any book author, you know, Marley and Me is a true story about my own life. It's about my wife and myself starting out in a marriage together and trying to figure life out and bringing this crazy dog Marley home. So it's a true story. And like all authors, you feel your book's kind of your baby and you're very protective of it. And no movie can really capture an entire book. You know, a book's about 300 pages, at least mine was. And a movie is 2 hours or less. And so they had to make compromises. I like to say that I think the movie was about 85% accurate and 15% dramatic license. What I did appreciate, though, is that I was made a consultant on the movie set. So I was able to read the scripts and give feedback. And I felt that I was listened to. So when they deviated from the true story, and they were mostly in minor ways, but when they did that, I at least got to weigh in and have a discussion with them. And then they would tell me their reasons. And they usually did have a good reason, trying to compress this book into a shorter amount of time. And so I was good with it.
All right. And since you were helped weighing in, did they help ask you to help in writing of the script for the movie?
I did not play any role in writing, and I was grateful that I didn't. Some book authors do sign up to become a script writer or a co-script writer. When I started reading the scripts that these professional script writers in Los Angeles were turning in, I quickly realized that it's an entirely different type of writing, and I wasn't practiced enough at it to be good at it. And so I was very happy to let someone else do that. And then I was able to read what they did and give feedback and say, what if we did this instead? What if we brought this scene from the book into it? And I felt listened to. And in fact, there was two or three critical scenes where I walked away feeling like, you know, my input really helped to change that scene and to make it more true to life, to our real story. And so I was really satisfied with that.
Okay. And I heard, did this start as an article for the Philadelphia Inquirer?
In a way it did, yes. I mean, the short version of this story is that my wife and I had just gotten married, and we got this little cottage in West Palm Beach, Florida, down off the Intercoastal Waterway. And we got it all fixed up, you know, like a young couple will do with a brand new house. And we hand varnished our floors. We did all this work. And then we had the great idea to bring this little puppy home. And the puppy was Marley, who became this sort of famously neurotic, high energy, kind of borderline psychotic dog. And, you know, most of his antics were really funny, but he also really challenged us. And he turned our lives upside down at that critical juncture when young couples are trying to figure out how to make a life together. So he was really this influence that made a difference in how we developed as a couple. And he lived for 13 years. We had him in our lives for 13 years. And the book starts with us bringing him home, and it ends with us saying goodbye to him. So that was the trajectory of the story. And to get back to your question, the way that it came to be, I mean, I had been thinking about writing about Marley and Me for a long time. I was a newspaper columnist, and I found out that when I wrote about my own life, I usually got a bigger response from readers than if I was just writing about things in the, you know, in the news, like writing about the school board or something. And so I had this idea that, you know, my life actually, like all of our lives, you know, have stories in them that are worth telling. And I had written a few columns over the years about being saddled with the world's worst dog and these kind of tongue-in-cheek funny columns. After he died, I had this little pang of guilt. I mean, I was surprised at how much real grief I felt over a dog. And I think it had something to do with the fact of how much he challenged us. You know, it was like we really had to work at this relationship with this animal. And consequently, it was a pretty close bond. But I felt kind of guilty. Like I wanted to set the record straight. Like, yeah, he was a really bad dog in many respects. He caused thousands of dollars worth of damage to our house. He alienated neighbors, you know, he stole people's underwear off their clotheslines, on and on. But the part of the story I never told was what a sweet dog he was and how gentle he was with our children, how much he protected us. You know, we were in kind of a changing neighborhood that had some crime in it, and we always felt safe with this big, powerful dog in our midst. And so that's when I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I was a Metro columnist at the time. And this was late 2003, and I decided to tell that the full story. And I wrote this one column saying that and saying goodbye to him. And I like to say that a column is kind of a litmus test on how you did as a writer, because the next morning you either get a lot of email and phone calls or you don't. And I broke records on how many people responded to that column. And that's what gave me the courage to turn it into a book. It was that one column.
While you were writing the book and you were still employed at the Philadelphia Inquirer, did you get any pushback from your editors for trying to write a book while you're still a columnist?
No, not at all. I mean, really, for columnists are given a lot of freedom. I like to say it's the best job at any newspaper. There's a lot of pressure on you to be interesting. But you have total freedom. I would pick my topics. So one day I might be writing about a crime in our community. One day I might be writing about cutbacks to the state budget. One day I might be writing about, you know, washing my car in my driveway and something that happened. So I had the freedom to do that. And my editors really didn't care what I was doing as long as I was delivering three interesting columns a week. And they didn't even know I was writing a book until I had actually finished it and sold it. And then I walked in and told them, and they were kind of like, oh, okay, good for you. You know, they really didn't care. The one thing that's interesting as a writer I found is that you might assume that by writing a book, you were draining your creative energy from your day job of writing a newspaper column. But I had the opposite effect. I really felt that my column helped energize me for my early morning and late night writing of the book. And conversely, the book energized me. So when I showed up at work, I just had this sort of excess of creative energy that they were playing off each other. And the column was percolating ideas that then spilled over into my book writing time. And the thrill and the adrenaline of writing the book would have me wake up in the morning with more creative energy for my column than I would normally have. So it was a very fertile time for me as a writer. And, you know, we all go through those dips and valleys where we don't feel very creative and we struggle to kind of find a voice and find something to say. For me, this was not one of those times. It was a time where the two worked together really well. And the book came out of me surprisingly fast. I averaged a chapter a week. So it was 32 chapters, 32 weeks. I had my book done, all while writing three columns a week.
You said nothing suffered. Who was your biggest critic while writing this book? Was it your wife or was it your editor?
Well, like I said, my editor didn't know about the book. So there was really no input in that. And my wife didn't know too much about it either. She knew I was working on something. I'm a little superstitious as a writer. I feel like if I talk too much about a project before it's out of me, that I'll jinx it and I'll dry up and it'll never come out of me completely. So I kind of kept quiet. When I was done with the book, since it's a really personal story about our marriage and our lives as a couple, the first one to read it, of course, was her. And so I shared it with her. And I was a little concerned that she might feel it was invading her privacy. I mean, I wrote about her miscarriage and about trying to get pregnant and about all the things couples go through. And my wife's a journalist also. And she said the thing that every writer wants to hear. She said, you know, if you can't tell the story honestly, you shouldn't be writing this book. You should find a new topic. And, I don't have any problems with how you're telling our story. It's how I remember it also. And, you know, if you're meant to tell this story, and I think you are, then you need to tell it fully and honestly. So she was really great about it. And really, my editing as I went was all between myself and my literary agent, who I was sharing chapters with each week as I finished them. And she'd give me feedback. And for the most part, her feedback was, I like what I'm seeing, keep going. I think she just wanted to get the first draft of this book out of me. And so that's how I bumped through it. And by the time it was done, then I had something to work with. And then we went into the revision process. And from there, we took it out and sold it.
So after that book, were you still working with The Enquirer?
Yes. Marley and Me came out in October of 2005. And I was a columnist at The Enquirer, and I stayed at The Enquirer as it jumped onto the bestseller list and started growing organically. It just kind of a word of mouth, it started spreading. And each week my sales went a little higher and my place on the bestseller list went a little higher. And in February of 2006, it hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and it stayed there for a half a year. So it was, for any writer, it was a really heady experience. It was also a really busy time because of that, my publisher had me on book tour a lot. So I had to keep taking breaks from my column, or else I was trying to write my column from the road, or I was phoning in from remote locations. And it was tough. I mean, I think if things suffered in my column writing, it was probably that period because I felt spread too thin. I knew I wanted to write this second book about my childhood, The Longest Trip Home. And I'd been thinking about this book for a long time. And it was at that point when I was about to start writing that I knew that, you know, I could keep trying to do this column for my regional audience in Philadelphia, or I could take a break and just dedicate myself to trying to get this book done and doing the best job I could. So I resigned in 2007. Early 2007, I think it was February. And then just immediately, I stopped working on a Friday, and that weekend, I started writing The Longest Trip Home and immersed myself in that. It took me about a year. It was not pure writing because the movie came out, was getting ready to come out at the same time, the Marley and Me movie. So I was sort of juggling writing and being on set for the movie and reading over the scripts for the movie. So I was kind of between those two, but it became clear to me. I didn't want to keep doing the column if I couldn't give it everything that it deserved. And that was the point where I realized that it was time to take a break. So I've been self-employed just as a book writer and teaching here at Lehigh since 2007.
All right. And talking about that, how does Lehigh tie into The Longest Trip Home? Like, I know you had some connection with Lehigh and the writing of The Longest Trip Home.
Right. In fact, I think I've told this story in our class that we have together. I was looking for, as a journalist, I always had a newsroom and a place to go to work and I was used to that environment of working with other busy people around me. And then when I quit my newspaper job, I was trying to sit at home and write, and it felt, I felt like a prisoner, I was having a hard time being creative. So I started looking around for places I could get out of the house to write. And I'm a little fussy that way. A coffee shop felt too busy. Restaurants didn't feel right. Bars didn't feel right. I went to our local public library and all the little kids are there having reading hour. That didn't feel right. So I kept stumbling around until I ended up on the Lehigh campus, which is about 20 minutes from where I live. And I walked into the Linderman Library, and I'd been in it before and I knew how beautiful it was and is. And I sat down with my laptop and I just felt like this is the place I was meant to write at. It was quiet, but it was full of creative energy. I was surrounded by people working hard on their own work and in their books and doing their own writing and research and reading. And so I had the quiet, but I also had that energy. And I didn't write the whole book there, but I probably wrote two-thirds of the book there. And I just started making it part of my routine. I just show up and go sit at a table in the library. And when I was done, I was thankful for Lehigh allowing me to do this, even though I didn't ask permission. I just showed up and nobody bothered me. I guess I declared squatter's rights at Linderman Library. And so I put it in my acknowledgments page. I said, I'd like to thank Lehigh University for letting me do this. And that acknowledgement began a discussion with some of the people here at Lehigh, and I ended up giving a talk about my book on campus. And I just really love the community, the faculty and the students and the staff. And that's what got me thinking about it'd be kind of fun to teach a class here. I just feel like I kind of belong here. It's like I feel part of this community. So I started talking with Jack Lulley, Professor Lulley, who's the chairman of the journalism department. And I said, I had this idea. I'd like to teach narrative nonfiction writing, which is kind of what I do. And he liked the idea. And so this is my third year, I believe, of doing this, of teaching this class here.
This is Prof Talk.
In class, you tell us to read a lot and write a lot. Is there a favorite book you have to read?
Well, boy, that's a tough question because there's so many good books out there. And, different books mean different things to you at different times in your life. When I was a little kid, it was Johnny Tremaine, this young reader's book about a fictional character during the Revolutionary War. In high school, it was The Catcher in the Rye. It was the book that really caught my imagination. And I didn't quite fully get it, I think, as a high school student, but it touched me on some kind of an emotional level. I think because I was an awkward, shy kid, like Colden Hawfield a little bit, like the character in the book. And I ended up reading that book, I think, four or five times through college. Also in high school, I discovered Steinbeck. And I think by the time I was halfway through college, I'd read pretty much all of Steinbeck's work. And Hemingway followed, and Fitzgerald, those great mid-20th century American authors. And I just bumped my way with a lot of fiction that it kind of inspires my work, even though I primarily write nonfiction. And there's been also some just great pieces of narrative nonfiction writing over the years. Some of the literary journalists that came out of the Vietnam War and came out of the 80s and the 90s were really influential in shaping me as a writer. And so I tell my students that you know, just like you really can't hope to be a good violinist if you don't listen to other violinists who are really good at what they do. It's really hard to become an accomplished writer if you're not reading other writers who know what they're doing. And you just subconsciously are absorbing their voice and cadence and pacing and organization. And things that sound effortless really take years and years of honing to get to that point. And a great way to have a shortcut to that is to just read these writers and to listen to their voices and just enjoy their books. And it's like this subconscious rub off, and it makes a difference. It really made a difference for me, and I see it in other people as well.
Going back to writing chapter by chapter for turning books in.
Right.
When an editor returns a chapter all marked up with corrections or maybe you should change this here, does it sting the soul at all for you?
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, you know, I think every writer is this nervous bundle of ego and insecurities. And so no writer really wants to hear anything other than it's awesome just the way it is. Perfect. Don't change a word. But we all know that writing is all about revision. It's unlike, let's say, a performance art where it's all about the practice that comes before the performance. In writing, you have that opportunity to go back and fix things and to polish. And that's just the process. I think you can take the most famous, beautifully crafted piece of writing, and if you looked at the first draft of it, it would probably be a little clunky in places and a little rough and disorganized. And that's just the way it goes. I mean, so, you know, we talk about it in writing classes, and I think writers mostly talk about it too, is that there are different drafts you go through, and there's different states of minds that go with those drafts and different things you're trying to do. So in draft one, really it's all about unlocking your soul and just trying to get that story that's inside of you out and trying to figure out how to share with the world something that up to this point is internalized. It's all bouncing around in your head. And so if you worry too much about structure, grammar, spelling, word choice, all those things, you could end up stifling yourself and not being able to get that story out. All those things are really important, but I think most writers have figured out that it's important to just get it out of you so you have something on paper that you can then fix, you can then polish. And if you are trying to polish it and have every word and sentence come out perfectly, that's a big onus to put on anyone's shoulders, and you'll probably end up being frozen with writer's block. So draft one is really just getting it out of you. And then draft two, for me anyways, is it kind of goes hand in hand with draft one. As I'm writing draft one, I kind of keep going to the top of it and I'm reading what I've written and kind of fixing it as I read it. And then I get to the point where my furthest point I'm at, and then I continue to write. So by the time I'm done with draft one, it's really gone through draft two and maybe even three. And then it's time to get some input, as you mentioned, and people will read your work. And of course, everyone's going to have an opinion of how you can make it better. And then it's your job to listen to those voices and figure out how to listen to them, you know, because readers are readers. You know, they're a representation of who's going to be reading your book out there in the real world, and figure out how you want to change things to meet those concerns, but also stay true to your own voice. It's a little bit of a ballet. It's a kind of a dance. And then there's different layers of that. And each time, hopefully, if you're doing it in a way that's working, each draft is getting you a little closer and you're feeling a little better about it until that point where you're finally ready to let it go, release it.
You've written two books. On the second book, did the return of work with markups sting less?
No, it was no different, really. And I have to say, you know, Marley and Me was one of those books, you know, that was kind of a blessing, that it just kind of poured out of me pretty easily. I'd been thinking about that book for a long time. I knew there was something there. I knew it was more than just a story about a crazy dog. I knew it was really more a story about a young couple in its formative stages and how the dog was the catalyst to help shape that couple and form them. So as I was living those 13 years, I was doing a lot of, in my head, kind of informal structural outlining and thinking. Plus, I wrote some columns and essays about it. Plus, I kept a journal. So I was writing in my journal about these things. So by the time I went to write it, it kind of poured out of me. Like I said, I did a chapter a week. And then when it got to the revision stage, you know, we kind of did polishing work, but there wasn't a lot of like dramatic revision involved. When I wrote The Longest Trip Home, that was more challenging for me because now that takes place over a 40-year window. And the first 20-some years of that, I really wasn't thinking like a writer. I wasn't keeping a journal. I wasn't keeping documentation of things to help me remember. So there was a lot of rebuilding scenes and rebuilding. I did a lot of reporting on that. I went back and pulled up old documents, old calendars, my father's checkbook receipts, anything that would like help me build the chronology of our life as a family. And so it was a longer process, and the revision editing process was also longer because I think it came out of me more in a jumble. And then the trick then was to sort of like cut out the things that weren't relevant to the real story and pull it together and tighten it. And so I spent more time in the revision stage. It wasn't really a painful process. It was, I was happy with the first draft. I knew I had something there, but I also realized that it was kind of flabby and sloppy. And it wasn't so much what I had wasn't good. It was what I had that was around those things. So it was sort of more condensing and trimming and making decisions on what scenes advance the story and what scenes may have been amusing at the time, but they really have nothing much to do with the bigger story of this evolution from childhood into adulthood. So that's what got me to that point.
From WLVR Bethlehem and Lehigh University, this is Prof Talk.
Welcome to Prof Talk. This is Michael Presida. I'm here with author John Grogan.
And you mentioned writer's block. Have you suffered with writer's block, and how did you overcome writer's block?
Every writer, I think, has at least some periods where they suffer from writer's block. And I'm among them. There's been periods where I wake up and nothing sounds good to me, and I feel deflated. And then there's other times when I bubble over and I can't wait to just get to a computer and just start getting things down. I think every writer kind of finds little tricks and techniques, and I have one. I've shared it in class, I know. And it's kind of a silly little mind game I play with myself. And I know it's a mind game, but it still seems to work for me to break things loose a little bit. I do all my work on a computer, so I'll have a Word document open in front of me, and I'll title it Chapter 1. And this is the official first chapter of a book that I hope to someday have published. And I put tremendous pressure on myself that opening sentence has to be really a killer opening sentence. You know, we all hear about like how important that opening sentence is. People will either continue or they'll put it down. And so that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself. And I'll sit there and I'll stare at that blank screen. And at some point in my life, I figured out, I think it was while I was a newspaper columnist, that you can open another screen up next to it. And you can just, at the top of that, you just say scrap notes or something like that. I think I usually say scrap notes. So I'm right up front, I'm labeling it. This is just scrap. This is like junk. This is meant for nobody's eyes but my own. And suddenly all that pressure is off from you. It's like, well, this is just junk anyway. So I can just kind of like sort of start like free associating. I can throw anything on here I want. And so I do. I just start saying like, oh, I think I'm going to say this. Maybe I want to talk about this. And as I bump my way through those rough notes, I usually end up bumping my way into actual language that will end up in my book. And I've used this trick over and over. And it kind of works even while at the moment I'm saying like, this is a stupid trick. I know it's a stupid trick, but it kind of works for me. We talked about the writer John McPhee, the very celebrated nonfiction writer. And we were just talking about this in class today, that his trick when he's stuck is to write a letter to his mother. And he starts out, "Dear mother, I can't think of what to write about this story. And this is what the story is about. And here's some of the details that I know I need to figure out how to talk about." And in the act of writing this letter to his mother that his mother will never see, he bumps his way into the language that will become his article. And so, you know, I've never had debilitating writer's block that lasts forever. But, you know, it's something that we all struggle with.
From WLVR Bethlehem and Lehigh University, this is Prof Talk.
All right. And another question going back to, I'm kind of a dog person. I have three at home, not on campus, but back at my parents' house. I was just wondering, have you had a dog since Marley?
Yes, actually, we've had a few. After Marley died, our whole family, I was surprised at like the level of loss and grief, not just that my wife and I felt, but our three children who were pretty young at the time felt. My youngest, who was just a little girl at the time, I think she was about eight or something, she just couldn't talk about him. You know, if we'd bring his name up, she would just, you know, clench her fist and say, "Don't talk about him." And so we all went through this period of like, you know, we're just not ready to get another dog. And that lasted about 9 months or so. And then we went out and started shopping for dogs. And we found this beautiful Labrador retriever. This time it was a female. And we kind of had done our homework. We kind of learned with Marley that the parentage is important with especially purebred dogs. And if you want to sort of know what their personality will be like, look at both parents. We hadn't done that with Marley. And so, you know, the father and the mother were both at this place, and there was a well-regarded breeder. And they were like really calm hunting stock types of dogs. And sure enough, she was also. But that's what she was. She was a hunting dog and really not so much a family dog. And in fact, her greatest pleasure in life was killing our backyard chickens. You know, we lived out in the country and we had chickens, and she just was a predator. You know, she was a great dog and she was loving with us as a family, but she mostly was a hunter. And we actually ended up on Cesar Millan's show on Animal Planet, The Dog Whisperer, because he'd caught wind of the fact that we had this dog who was a hunter and we were not hunters. And he came and gave us pointers and tips and worked with her on how to kind of redirect that energy into something that wouldn't keep killing all the animals in the neighborhood. So that was Gracie. And unfortunately, it was really sad. She got sick pretty early in her life. I think she was seven. And she got Lyme disease, and she had this really unusual reaction where some dogs, and it's mostly retrievers, in trying to fight the Lyme disease, they basically attack their own organs, and her kidneys shut down. And we had her at the University of Pennsylvania, and we did everything in our power, and there was no way to save her. So that was really hard on us because, you know, she's meant to live 13 years or so, and she was only halfway through her life. And again, we went through a period of grief and mourning for her. And then we were on the movie set for Marley and Me. It was being filmed in early 2008. And they had all these Labrador puppies on the set to play the young puppy Marley. And we were there and we got to play with the puppies and hang out with them. And it was pretty obvious to everybody that we were pretty crazy about these puppies. So in the last week of shooting, the director and the producer of the movie called us over and they presented us with one of the puppies. And he was a gift. And so I like to joke that his 15 minutes of fame was over by the time he was 10 weeks old, because he was just a little 10-week-old puppy, or he might have been 12 or 14 weeks, but he was young. And then we brought him home. So we still have him. His name is Woodson. And we liked him so much. He's just a beautiful and a really calm dog that we went back to the same breeder and we got another Labrador from them. So he had a companion. So we have two Labradors now and a cat and a pen full of chickens. So that's our menagerie.
Are either of the labs as rambunctious as Marley was?
No, quite the opposite. They're they kind of are model behavior dogs. You know, they're spirited and they like to have fun, and especially the younger one loves to run around and high energy, but calms right down, naturally well behaved. And you know, after I wrote the book, I took a fair amount of criticism from animal trainers and animal owners who take pride in their ability to train their pets and have really well regimented dogs at being kind of a total screw up as a dog trainer, and to which I plead totally guilty. We're really good on the love and the nurturing of an animal, not so good on being the alphas and controlling them. But for whatever reason, the same two adults, same two owners, my wife and I, had really good luck with the other dogs we had. So I do think a big part of Marley was his lineage. He was just a high-strung dog. And some of these Labradors, if you ever go to shelters, you see they're usually full of these big, powerful male Labradors who people can't control and they give up on. And the one thing that we are proud of and also just really happy that we did is that we gave Marley a home for his entire life. We didn't give up on him. When a lot of people were telling us we should, a lot of people were saying, like, why don't you just give that dog to the shelter? It's like destroying your house. And now in hindsight, look how he changed our lives. You know, he gave me the inspiration for a book that became a bestseller and allowed me to change my career and go from newspapers to book writing, and all because that of this dog who challenged us and we stuck with instead of walking away from. So when I talk to people, and I do talks around the country a fair amount, you know, a lot of people like love the idea of getting a dog, but I warn them to, like, you know, a dog's, it's not a washing machine or a Chevrolet. You know, you don't just get rid of it when you're tired of it. It's a living thing, and it's a sensitive living thing with feelings and emotions, and they're very social animals. And, you know, you don't bring an animal home unless you're committed to keeping them and providing for them, you know, not just food and water, but medicine and health care and love and affection and all those things that go into that relationship. And I'm an example of, if you do stick with that, in the end, I think it almost always works out. And the people who have really bad experiences with dogs is getting discouraged and not investing, and they stop investing in the animal with their time. And the more alone the animal is, the more isolated, the more they're going to act out. They're social animals and they start going crazy. And if you're willing to invest the time in an animal and have that bond with them, the animals almost always pay you back. And as the human, you end up walking away with the better end of the deal.
Like, my final question I have written down, other than reading and journaling, are there any other pieces of advice you would have for any of the listeners who might want to become nonfiction narrative writers?
Oh, boy. I mean, the main thing is to just start writing. You know, it's like, it's not the kind of thing you can really just think about for years and then hope that when you finally sit down to write your story, it's going to come out great. It's a learned art. There's a lot of craft to it, but there's also a lot of art and a lot of heart, a lot of your own sort of emotional energy. And the best way to start exploring it, if you think you might want to be a writer, is to just start writing. Write for yourself, write privately, write in a blog, write on Facebook or Twitter, any little thing you can do to, like, be putting words down and sharing them. Because really, what's a writer if you don't have readers? So, you know, there's some things that are meant to stay private, and that's what your journal's for. I'm a huge believer in journals as a tool for helping you develop as a writer, develop your voice, also capture moments in your life while they're fresh. So in 5 years, when you want to write about that period of your life, you have a raw first level document that you can go to and refresh your memory. But in addition to the journal, I think it's important to share your writing. And it might just be a blog that you share with friends and family, or it might be a blog that you put out and then promote on Facebook and Twitter and see who comes to it and see what sticks. And the more you write, the more comfortable you're going to get with that. And also reading. You know, I am a firm believer that, and we've talked about this earlier in the program, that the more you read, the more you're going to absorb the whole culture of the power of words and that relationship, how these little black letters organized into groupings on a white screen or a white piece of paper have amazing power, you know, depending on how they're arranged, in what order, and how they bring things out of the human experience. So that's all a powerful part of it. And, you know, for me, one of the greatest rewards of being a writer is what I hear from readers. You know, they're complete strangers, really, but we don't feel like strangers when they write me letters. And, you know, they've read my words about my own life, and something about my story resonated with them. And then they share things about their life, and we have never met and we will never meet in person. And yet there's this odd sense of intimacy and warmth that you get in that relationship between a writer and a reader. And it is a very, for me anyways, a very rewarding relationship. And I just value that so much. And when I left my newspaper column, I was so used to that, like that flow of two or three times a week, I would get emails and phone calls and letters in the mail from readers. And I stopped writing that column, and they continued for a while, you know, people who still wrote me, but then, you know, they petered out. And that was kind of a tough period for me, because I was suddenly like adrift without that relationship. And then when my book came out, and then I started getting those kind of responses again, but now they were from all over the country and all over the world. Marley and Me's in 40 languages around the world. So it's kind of a cool feeling to get a letter from, you know, 16-year-old in Indonesia, or a, you know, retired man in Barcelona or something, telling me about reading my book in their native language and how it reflects on their own life. So that all goes into the experience, and for me is kind of why I do it. I keep going forward because I'm hungry for that relationship.
All right, and I just remembered one thing. You said in class a while ago that the things that are probably most potent, something along the lines of the things that are most, that will be your best article, let's say if you're writing for a newspaper, are things that you're not emotionally ready to tell.
Yes, I have made that argument. And I'm really talking about when you're writing about your own life. So first person writing, like if you're writing essays about your life or a column that minds your own life. Sometimes it's the most difficult topics that you are initially afraid to like write about, or you say, there's no way I could ever share that. It's just too intimate. It's too personal. And some things really are meant to stay private, but there are those topics though, once you can get over that hurdle and say, okay, I think I'm ready to write about them now. In my experience has been, those tend to be the topics that resonate with other people, because, you know, we all share the same basic human experience over culture lines and ethnic lines and national lines. And if you're writing about a painful moment in your life or an embarrassing moment or whatever it is, there's a really good chance that many, many people out there have had similar experiences. Maybe not just like yours, but yours is similar enough that they can nod their head and say, yep, yep, that was like what happened to me. And, you know, I think the bottom line, the end result, is we're all trying to explore this existence we're on, you know, this human experience. We're on planet Earth, and we live and we die, and we're trying to understand that experience, and the best writing helps illuminate that experience. So if you're willing to open up your armor and share those parts of your experience that are meaningful and that have something that helps elevate the conversation, I'm almost positive that you'll be rewarded for that. And I know that's been my experience. When I've taken the safe way out and kind of pulled my punches, I look back on that piece of writing and I think, like, this doesn't feel totally honest. It feels like, you know, I'm trying not to embarrass myself. When I sort of just let it hang out there, and sometimes maybe it's a cringe moment, but I think in the end it's I'm rewarded for that because it feels honest. It is honest.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today, Professor Grogan.
Thank you, Michael. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Prof Talk. This is Michael Pacita.
You've been listening to
Prof John Grogan on today.
To hear all the interviews and check out extended material, log on to our archives at WLVR.org.